You're listening to Just Ask the Question, Adventures in Reporting with your host, Brian Karam.
Hi, and welcome back to Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, for our weekend edition called Just Ask the Press, a look at the news of the week with former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and editor-at-large and also the senior White House correspondent from CQ Roll Call, John T. Bennett. This week, we're taking a look at Donald Trump's first week in criminal court. Did he violate his gag order? We're also going to unravel some of the Supreme Court considerations that are going on. How fast will the Donald Trump trial go? Meanwhile, Biden and the cannibals. There's a story that John is eager to tell, and we are eager to talk about. The horrible White House briefing room questions and answers of this week. Was it the worst press briefing I've seen in my life? Yes, it is. The latest polling information. Does Michael Johnson have a prayer of avoiding removal? And there are hints that Democrats and Republicans are actually working together in Congress. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Anyway, Iran and Israel and much more. So stick around. This is Just Ask the Press, and we will be right back.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth with Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not released anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we're back. It is Just Ask the Press. I am your host, Brian Karam. With me today, as always, is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and editor-at-large from CQ Roll Call and senior White House correspondent John Bennett. And guys, let's start with the look. This week, Donald Trump, it's all Donald Trump. So, the Senate averts an impeachment trial, actually, in Homeland Security. Let's start with that. Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. And Michael, you can unpack that for me.
Well, Mayorkas was impeached narrowly in the House, essentially over a disagreement with House Republicans on immigration policy. There was no real allegation of criminal behavior or high crimes and misdemeanors, which is an abuse of the office. It was, we disagree with your immigration policy. So to get back at you Democrats for impeaching our side, we're going to impeach your side. The exact opposite of what the framers thought impeachment should be, which was more or less a nuclear option. And so, because the system is set up that the House impeaches, essentially indicts, and the Senate tries the case and then has to vote to convict, it went to the Senate for trial, and as expected, and as everyone knew when it was on the House side, the Senate voted immediately, or essentially immediately, to acquit, and the case is over. So the House wasted a lot of time that really our economy and our world doesn't have to waste with this crazy Mayorkas impeachment. Now, that said, and the audience is saying, yeah, but what about the Democrats having done the same thing for Trump? We've talked about this before, and I've expressed my skepticism of the integrity of the Ukraine impeachment. I thought that
the
that was really the Ukraine impeachment. I thought that that was a terrible phone call that Trump had with Zelensky.
Not perfect, as he argues.
It was tantamount to a shakedown, but I would not have thought that rose to the level of an impeachable offense. And so those who are out there in the audience thinking, well, we're one-sided, you know, it's good to criticize the Republicans for Mayorkas and we say nothing about Trump. I want to be on the record as saying, I think both Ukraine and Mayorkas were badly considered impeachments. Whereas January 6th, I think was a righteous impeachment. And if Senator McConnell had it naively thought that Trump would go quietly into the good night, and that we would be done with him, and the criminal justice system would run its course and take care of the sanctions that were necessary for that, he wouldn't be a candidate today. But that's
so, John.
Just looking back,
essentially, they impeached Mayorkas for not taking care of the border, but they haven't passed legislation that would take care of the border. Have you ever? I mean, you and I have talked about the dysfunction of Congress, but I don't think anything shows how dysfunctional it actually is, or highlights it as well as that action. Your thoughts?
Oh yeah, the Senate crafted, actual senators, not leadership, which is important, came up with a border security bill. It was part of a broader bill. And it was, you know, it was pretty conservative. Some Democrats were upset with it because it didn't have things for, you know, the Dreamers and Pathway to Citizenship, things that they've pushed for, you know, for a decade now. That wasn't in this bill. There was a lot of conservative priorities that Biden and the Senate Democrats decided to go along with. And, you know, experts called it the most conservative immigration package in well over a decade. And of course, we know what happened with that. Donald Trump said it out loud that it would help Biden and Democrats.
Therefore, it wasn't passed.
Right. So he told congressional Republicans to oppose it. Suddenly enough of them did. And, you know, it didn't see the light of day in the end. And you're right. So they could pass that in the Senate today, by the way, as we record on Saturday. Both chambers, very rare, are working today. Both chambers could pass that thing with probably 2/3 majorities, and yet it just sits there. So it's you're right. They have created a problem by not being part of the solution. They've created a problem, and they're trying to use it to bash Biden and Democrats over the head campaign-wise. But a funny thing is happening. Biden has caught up in a lot of polls. He's closed the distance within the margin in a lot of places on Trump. So it's not right now. I don't think that the immigration message was working for a long time, but something's going on right now.
Well, we're going to get into some of that in a bit, but
yeah.
But to your point, I guess I'm going to bring this up now. There has been some bipartisan agreement on some things. You know, one of the, and we'll talk, all of this is so related, we'll talk a little bit about the terror in the White House briefing room, but one of the things that, you know, has come out is the Ukraine bill, the TikTok legislation. All of that is agreed upon. The mm-hmm. president and the Republicans are agreeing on some of these big issues, which has been very rare up to now. Yes.
Yeah, there's a massive package of emergency spending measures for Ukraine, for Israel, for Taiwan, and other Indo-Pacific partners that's moving right now. And included in that, as you mentioned, is a bill that would force the divestiture of the TikTok social media company, app, whatever you want to call it. Or it would be, if it's not divested to U.S. ownership, and I think 2 years is what this bill says, then it would be banned.
And both the Republicans and the Democrats and the president are in agreement on it.
Oh, right.
That's, I mean, so the idea is basically, I mean, we'll get into the nefarious parts of it later, but the idea is we're actually seeing some, Biden has affected some bipartisan cooperation.
Well, what was played down a little bit by both sides was a phone call early this week. We didn't hear about it immediately, between Speaker Mike Johnson, very conservative, and President Biden. They talked about Johnson's approach to these bills, and they agreed on the substance. That this speaker and this president agreed on this. Biden gave him the thumbs up, and I thought it was pretty remarkable when the bill text came out on Wednesday. Sorry. The White House had a statement out embracing these bills within the hour.
Within 15,
which is
minutes.
Remarkable for them. Yeah. They're not that fast.
No, they aren't. But Mike,
this is very bipartisan. The rule for the package passed the House on Friday with over 300 votes and a majority of both parties, I believe. So this is very bipartisan. The White House is fully behind these bills. And again, these were negotiated by Mike Johnson, who is, he's pretty MAGA. I mean, he was just at Mar-a-Lago. So there is a moment here, and this, I still think this is good for Biden. I mean, everybody gets a little something to run on here in these bills, but Biden gets to say, look, I did it again. I did it with infrastructure. I did it with the CHIPS and Science Act, and now I've done it with these, with aid for our allies, and he gets to go run on it. And this is what he ran on in 2020. I'll get things moving again. It's not pretty. It's noisy. It's not that much fun to cover, but he's got a handful of things now, real legislative victories to go run on, and he's going to be back on the trail this week, and Trump's going to be in court.
Michael, well, we're going to get to that in a minute, but how do you think it plays in the public seeing actual bipartisanship at work? Does it matter?
I think it does. I think people want functional government. Remember, Clinton, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, Clinton and Gingrich for a while had a working relationship. And the government, until Gingrich shut it down, the government functioned effectively, or certainly not dysfunctionally. And, you know, we saw that when Teddy Kennedy and Orrin Hatch worked together on education and other bills, things got done. And that trickles down into local communities when you see that there is money to build a road or fix a bridge or create jobs or protect the environment. I think those things, when they trickle down into the communities and you see the impact of it practically, not, you know, in theory, you know, my favorite quote of Yogi Berra is, in theory, there's no difference between theory and practice. In practice, there is.
Thunk it.
And so in practice, yeah.
That's my favorite Yogi Berraism, but go ahead.
I loved, he said, nobody goes there anymore. It's too crowded.
It ain't over till it's over.
But Yogi Berra-isms aside, I do think it's good for everyone politically. Not just, I think this is good for Johnson. Who it's not good for is those who don't want government to function, who want to see a deconstruction of democracy and a functional government. And so I think...
And speaking of Donald Trump...
As conservative as Johnson is, he's not Marjorie Taylor Greene. He's not Matt Gaetz. He's not those Steve Bannon, who would like to see the state
fail.
And so I think it's good for him. It's good for Biden. We'll see how it plays out at the very end in November. But it's more importantly, it's good for the average American who will now get their potholes filled because there's infrastructure money, or their school rebuilt because there's education money, and on and on and on.
Up a point, and that's where we're going to pivot next to, is those who want to destroy government. And speaking of which, as I said, Donald Trump was in court this week, and he sent out mailers, by the way, if you haven't seen him, about how, you know, they're making me go to court. It's the Biden plot to keep me from being with you guys. It's, you know, it's a sham. It's the deep state coming to get me. And meanwhile, he's facing, this is historic, folks. The first time a former president has ever appeared in court for a felony charge. He's on trial in New York. All the wags have weighed in about how, you know, the DA has him cornered. He's going, it's an imminently going to prison, blah, blah, blah. Did he violate, I have a couple of questions for you, Michael. Did he violate his gag order? And what does it say about the jurors, some of the prospective jurors? You know, we do have a jury seated now in the alternates, and I guess the trial will commence. But what's your take on that first week of the trial? Do you think it's a Donald Trump says it's a, you know, the deep state coming after him. The prosecutor's going, no, you know, this is the guy committed a crime and we're going after him. Prosecuting.
There, no.
So you've asked a couple of questions in one, and I'll try
unpack it as best as you can, brother.
So first, the surprise of everybody, and everyone includes me, who last Sunday on Wolf Blitzer's TV show said, he said, well, this jury selection will take a few days. I said, I think it'll take a week or two. And it didn't take a week even. So to the surprise of everybody.
So you're very accurate in your predictions of what you're telling me.
Yes. Yes. My very first day on television was the day of the verdict in the O.J. Simpson case. And I was asked by CNN host Greta Van Susteren, as we were waiting for the verdict, what did I think? And I said, I think he'll get convicted of second degree murder. So I can tell you my career on television has started with a mistake and is that is continuing.
And that's why you're successful.
That is
you're
my
as good
legacy.
As a weatherman.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Anyway, so back to the planet Earth. We saw a jury that selected quickly. We saw Judge Merchan running his courtroom very effectively. We saw jurors who, on first blush, said they didn't think they could be independent-minded, follow the evidence, immediately removed. And we saw the judge, I think, bend over backwards in the for-cause removal of jurors to remove jurors where there was a hint of a basis for cause. Each side got to use their peremptory challenges, that's their subjective challenges. And now we have a jury. And the jury, when you look at it, seems to be a fairly nice cross-section of Manhattanites. Some are better educated, some are less educated, some are wealthier, some are not as wealthy, some are older, some are younger. They're diverse gender and race. And you know, that's what the jury is supposed to be. And this notion that somehow I can't get a fair trial in New York from the mouth of a person who is multi-generational New York makes me, you know, sort of smile sarcastically.
I think that's called a smirk, go ahead.
So anyway, the trial is going to start on Monday with opening statements. And if the jury selection timeline is indicative of how the trial will go, this trial could be over in the end of May. This could be a 3 or 4 week trial. The big question that will be decided by the defense is, as the evidence comes in, what will be their ultimate decision about putting
Trump on the
stand?
That's my follow-up to you. Do you think they will put him on the stand?
I think the answer today, before the trial commences, is you got to be out of your mind to put him on the stand. But what it is, to use sports metaphors, as the trial proceeds, if you realize that you're down and you're deeply down and time is running out, then Trump may be your Hail Mary, meaning that he could be the person who gets you the one juror that hangs the jury. And remember
the one juror that's teetering will go the other way if you put him on the stand. Because here's my follow up to you.
Wait, let me just finish.
I've seen this before. Tom Capano on trial in Delaware thought they needed a Hail Mary. He said, I'm the guy that can carry the day. And his narcissistic ass got up on and he convicted himself. I mean, isn't that the concern that he'd get up there and just blow it?
Well, that's why I say to you today, if you're Trump's lawyer, you're keeping this guy off the stand. But if again to make John happy, if you're in the fourth period and you're down
touchdown
by, you know, a touchdown or no, even, you know, even 3 points or something, and the clock is running out, do you go long? And that's what they may have to do. And yes, the ball may get intercepted and or batted down and the game is over, or, you know, you may be Doug Flutie. So you just don't.
Donald Trump's not Doug Flutie.
So anyway, but the answer to your question is, I'd be surprised if he takes the witness stand, because I think he has a tendency to hurt himself when he talks in courtrooms more than he helps himself. But if as an act of desperation, lawyers feel like, what the hell, we're going down anyway, and maybe we can pull out a juror, you put him on. So that's that. The second part of your question is the gag order. And the gag order is pretty narrowly tailored to tell Donald Trump to not try to intimidate witnesses or otherwise threaten by speech court personnel, families of court members, and the like. And he has not been able to control himself, such that this was a very interesting ruling. In a court setting, as a courtesy, not a requirement, the prosecution, who always goes first because they've got the burden of proof, tells the defense, here's the order of our first few witnesses. You know, you have a witness list of 30 people.
And they don't have to do it.
As a courtesy, you often will say to the defense, by the way, I'm calling John, then Judy, then Jane.
Right.
And then you say, thank you very much, because that allows them to organize themselves. The defense says, so, prosecutors, who are your first three witnesses? And the prosecutors say, we're not telling you, because you can't control your client and he's going to start talking about them. And we don't want to risk that. And the defense says to the judge, you know, that's not right. The judge says, they're right. You can't control your guy. And they're within their right. And I completely get why they're not going to do this. Because you, defense attorney, tell us you will tell your client, but I have no confidence. And you know you have no confidence that you'll be able to control him. And so you'll just arrive on Monday and you'll find out who the first witness is when the first witness is called. So the judge has taken a very practical view of who Donald Trump as defendant is. And I think that if the judge is of the mind that Trump did violate his gag order 7 times, as the prosecutor says, he is going to sanction him. I think it's like $1,000 a violation, and maybe in escalating amounts. But I think he's
I don't think the money would have any effect on him, though. I think he's going to have to sit his ass in jail for a night and make him think about it.
Well, you know, people can disagree about that, but I think if each day you're getting fined $1,000 for violations of the gag order, I think after a while, as that message keeps seeping out, I don't think it's good.
I don't think money has any effect on Donnie.
I don't think it's good for you. I don't think it's good for you politically. I think that, and remember, one thing that we haven't raised is that on the eve of the conclusion of the selection of the jury, there was a self-immolation. Some guy set himself on fire in front of the courthouse. Now, I don't know. Maybe you guys know who he was and what was the protest.
Yeah, it didn't have anything to do. It had nothing to do with the trial. It was an ancillary issue, which is why.
Okay, I didn't know. Self-immolation.
Yeah.
I haven't seen since the Buddhists in Vietnam. So it was.
Well, there was one in D.C. not too long ago.
I don't pay attention, I guess.
Hey, Just Ask the Question podcast listeners. If you've got a second, head on over to Twitter and follow our official page, JATQ Podcast. That's JATQ Podcast.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth with Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not found anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we're back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, with our Sunday show, Just Ask the Press. With me, as always, is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and editor-at-large and chief White House correspondent from CQ Roll Call, John T. Bennett. When we left, Michael had astutely segued into the asking of questions in the White House, which is where I take us now. John, you and I were there Monday, last Monday, and I was amazed. I'm constantly amazed. I'm not skeptical anymore. I'm just amazed. But there have been some real breaches of etiquette and professionalism in the briefing room by reporters and by those who've been briefing us. But I asked what should have been a layup question last week about inflation after a Fox News reporter had talked about the rising gas prices and inflation. I said, you know, isn't it, you all are saying it's basically greedflation, and she couldn't even answer that. But we've seen
that couldn't get the dunk down. Could
no, could you? I was like, I just did it as a test to see if you could do it.
Yeah, you lobbed it right at the rim.
Here, go. And couldn't do it. But I've also seen, you know, like reporters have said they don't get phone calls returned. Mm-hmm. They don't get emails returned. The mm-hmm. staff isn't around. They ghost them. They lie to them. They don't, there's no give and take between the two staffs. Now, granted, we've asked some pretty damn stupid questions, including, you know, like whether or not earlier we were talking about the one question that was asked about steel production. Why would you want to produce steel in the United States?
I still can't. I can't. I don't even know if I can give commentary on it. It's just, it kind of a gotcha question, kind of a, do you understand how this works? Do you understand how this works? Like, there are things.
Why would
that
the U.S. want to produce its own steel? Oh my God!
And why would it be a big deal? Japan's an ally, so what's the big deal?
Right.
But wait a second.
Why would we want to be self-sufficient?
Right. You want to be self-sufficient. There are things that you want to do, especially as a superpower. Some experts would say the United States is the only superpower right now. And yeah, you want to be self-sufficient. You don't want to be buying your steel from the other guy, even if it is your friend. And there are things that there are things that the United States needs to do, and that's one of them. And I still don't understand the premise of the question. I cannot wrap my head around it.
Well, let me ask you this. You were gone from the White House for a while. You've come back. Your assessment of the press and the briefing. I mean, to me, look, I'll just be blunt. The worst I had in my early career was Reagan, but they were competent. They were intimidating and deflecting. And then the others have been everywhere from mediocre to bad. And of course, no one, I think, was any worse than Donald Trump. Therefore, it just started with Sean Spicer and went downhill to Kayleigh McEnany. But this group can barely crawl over that bar. I've never. You tell me. You're there. You're back for the first time. What's your impression?
Well, the briefings themselves, just there's not a ton of nutritional value there for information. I mean, yesterday was a. I thought Monday's briefing. John Kirby was there. National Security Communications. He's a chief national security spokesperson, basically. You know, when we get Admiral Kirby, the briefings are a lot better. There's just no way around that. Yesterday, you know, I thought Monday's was pretty good. He was feisty. We were feisty. We were pressing for information. You know, of course, last weekend, the U.S. helped and allies helped Israel thwart an attack by Iran, a retaliatory attack by Iran. So we were asking about that. Kirby was feisty, clearly had not had a lot of sleep, but it was good. It was a good back and forth. And then Friday, 4 days later, was one of the worst briefings I have ever seen. And I covered the Pentagon for a while. I covered the State Department. I covered the White House, of course. And it was one of the worst I have ever seen. The questions were bad. I thought the press secretary was not there to answer questions. I mean, just everyone can go to the White House website and pull up the transcript. How many times did she say, "I don't have anything for you on that"? She wouldn't confirm that Israel on Thursday overnight, counterattacked Iran's counterattack. She wouldn't even confirm it. And 4 days before that, you were sitting beside me, Brian, in the briefing room. Kirby's at the lectern bragging about a great intelligence collection. And
I asked him, remember? I asked him about that.
Yeah, that we have all over the Middle East. He said Iran didn't have to give us any pre-warning because we're the biggest, baddest intel collector in the region, and we knew, we detected what they were up to. And then four days later,
he doubled down on it too. When I asked him, I was the third one to ask him, and he said, and he said, no, we did not get advance notice from them. As you said, we didn't have to. That's what he said.
Right. And then 4 days later, Corinne Jean-Pierre, the press secretary, says, oh, we don't know what happened. We don't want to speculate what happened last night. It was just hypocrisy much. And then the questions yesterday were not good. And, you know, I haven't been called on regularly since I've been back. So full disclosure, I will see if I get my hand up and if I start getting some questions, if I can do any better.
Did we lose John?
I'm here.
We did. What he was about to say is a lot of sour grapes.
Well, you're back, John. Michael was interpreting you. Go ahead, finish your sentence.
Well, thanks, Michael. That's exactly what I was saying. The question just, they're not well informed.
Who's worse, us or her?
It depends on the day. And yesterday was an example. Everybody was bad. And, you know, sometimes you do. Sometimes you just get a clunker. Everybody's tired. Yeah. You know, everyone worked last weekend.
We're getting a lot of clunkers lately.
But it was a clunker. Friday was an all-time clunker.
So Michael, all-time clunker, how does it look from outside? Do you think that we're doing our job or that she's doing hers?
Wait a second. I'm sorry. I don't like the construction of that sentence. Michael, all-time clunker.
That's my Yogi Bearerism.
Can we restate that?
Michael,
that,
comma.
What do you think of others who may? Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Look, we've talked about how because of budgets or other things, the age of the average reporter is getting younger and younger. And as they get younger and younger, obviously, they are showing their inexperience more and more. And so when you get a question of, geez, why does America need manufacturing? You say, well,
every time I hear it, I have the same reaction.
In 1812, Thomas Jefferson told us it was the key to American independence. Maybe that's a hint, you know.
History.
But that's a problem. I think that the nature of the newsroom is getting more and more inexperienced, or its inexperience is showing more and more. And I think almost even at the podium, Kirby aside, because I think he's really good. I think that the press people, I mean, we saw this. No, I like him. He's a sort of a friend still from old days. But you saw this when Stephanopoulos was at the mic. He was too young and inexperienced for that position. You know, it wasn't like since Margaret Tutwiler or somebody that you had. Someone who
McCurry was the best I ever had. Oh, there, yeah,
yeah, McCurry. You know, but those guys were experienced, and they walked into that position capable of doing their job. And so you've got, you know, on both sides, you've got kids in positions that I think we would be advantaged if we had a little bit more gray.
You kids, get off my lawn.
Yeah, and one thing, Brian, that you and I have talked about, and others have commented on this as well, Corinne reads to us a lot.
Yeah.
She reads on Air Force. Right. And she's in her binder with these pre-written answers for things. And, you know, it's one thing to do that in the briefing room, because to some extent they all come in there with the giant binder with prep.
Sure.
But, you know, I think a lot about these Air Force One gaggles. They're supposed to be quick, obviously, because they're on plane, and they're about to land. And kind of impromptu, not impromptu, but a little less scripted,
right?
A little loose. I can tell we don't do travel pools, so I'm not on the plane, but you know, they live stream it. And I can tell when she's on the book, when she's on the plane.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just, it's not informing the people, and that should be the goal.
Yes. And with that said, on informing the people, ooh, I'm going to use it as a pivot point. Michael, the Supreme Court is informing us, more specifically, the court appears split over whether a federal statute on obstruction of an official proceeding applies to defendants involved in January 6th attack on the Capitol. The conservative justices have expressed various degrees of skepticism about the statute, which has been used to prosecute more than 350 people involved with a riot on the 6th. Now, look, if the skeptics win out, a number of those people will likely be resentenced or released from prison. And of course, it has an effect on the Donald Trump trial, does it not? Can you tell us, why? What's going on? Inform the people, baby.
So there was a prosecution against Arthur Anderson, the accounting firm, in connection with the Enron scandal 20-ish years ago. And I think actually Weissman of MSNBC fame may have been one of the prosecutors on that case. They charged Arthur Anderson with destroying documents to obstruct the proceedings. And the Supreme Court, and they obtained a conviction, but the Supreme Court reversed 9-0, saying that the prosecutors were overzealous, they misread that statute and its scope, and that it didn't cover the behavior that they charged criminally, and so the convictions were reversed. In the aftermath of that, Congress passes a new law which says it is not just a crime to tell others to do it, which is how the statute was written, but it's a crime for you to obstruct an investigation. And that all centered around the destruction of documents to obstruct a proceeding. Now, however, the statute has been used to cover things that are obstruction of official proceedings that are not documents related, because there's a word in the statute that says if you destroy, mutilate, or otherwise, or do this to documents, or otherwise obstruct an investigation, you shall be guilty. And so prosecutors have been saying you can destroy, mutilate, blah, 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 paper, or otherwise means doing something else to obstruct. And so the question is, you know, the meaning of is, what does the word otherwise mean? Does it mean you can destroy paper or do something different than, but which also has the impact of obstructing, or does otherwise mean destroy paper or otherwise doing something similar, obstruct a proceeding? And so that's where, you know, it's in the weeds legally, but that's what the debate is about. What is the scope of this statute? Does it cover people who break into the Capitol and obstruct the proceeding, or does it relate to the destruction of documents? And the justices seem split on how to interpret this. Some have said otherwise has to be read in connection with the prior sentence of paper destruction, that it means otherwise destroying.
Otherwise means otherwise. That's in other ways.
In similar ways. No, it's not other ways. It's the question of, does it mean in similar ways, meaning destroying paper in ways that we hadn't self-immolation of paper, you know, that we hadn't thought about, or does it mean, on the one hand, destruction of paper, and on the other hand, charging into the Capitol? That has nothing to do with paper. No one in these cases have been charged with destroying paper within the Capitol. And so that's the debate and in drafting this law. And it was not clear from the argument
how does that affect Trump?
Many newspapers said, well, two things. First, how does it affect those who've already been convicted? If the statute is inappropriately applied, those people who were convicted of that count And most of these people have been convicted of other things too. I think it was Clarence Thomas who said, essentially, like, why do you need this? You got them, you know, assaulting police officers and destroying property, and, you know, they're gonna go to jail if you think about it. But those who were, you know, either only convicted of this or had this be part of their conviction, that conviction will be vacated. In the case of Donald Trump, he's charged under that statute with interfering with not all of the counts. I think just two of the counts involve that, and we'll see how the wording of the decision applies to the Trump case, because he's different than he didn't go to the Capitol. He didn't charge the Capitol. He's not charged with that sort of behavior. He's charged, in a sense, with inciting people to do that. And so you get a decision by the Supreme Court which says anyone who just merely went into the White House, went into the Capitol, rather, will not have violated the statute. But if you told others to do it, if you told others to do this, then you may still fall within the ambit of this statute. So it will be litigated. And so here's the question that keeps me up at night, or keeps, I shouldn't say me, because I'm up at night. No, is let's say the Supreme Court says, if it's merely entering the building, that's not this statute. But if it's encouraging others to obstruct a proceeding, then maybe it is. And that's a fact determination. And so we send this back to say those two things. If it was just that you did it, then you're out. If you encourage others to do that, then maybe you're in, but you got to gather evidence on that. So now what does Jack Smith do? Now he's got two or one counts that might require further fact finding to keep those counts alive. If he keeps them in the indictment, then that gets litigated, then it appeals, and that gets delayed. Or does he say, you know what, I'm going to cut my losses. I'm going to jettison those things. I'll go to trial on the four remaining counts and leave for another day the application of this statute.
Can he say, Donald, let's just go to trial on these and we'll litigate the others later?
I don't know that he can sever counts that way. Generally speaking, it's hard to sever counts.
John,
anyway, this you know, conversation that we've had, as convoluted as it is, really is a perfect mirror of what happened in the Supreme Court. What does this word mean? How do you interpret it? You know, according to Webster,
Oxford,
your person, or how do you do it? To me, Blackstone, the legal interpreter of statutory construction. And the court said, I don't know, we've got to think about this, and we'll let you know in June.
John, I'm going to give you the last word on this. It seems to me that it's just a delay. Donald Trump's all about delay, and he found another point, a way to do it.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, that's Trump 101. that's been the legal strategy for all of this the entire time, and it will continue to be. I wanted to ask Michael, I'll yield back to Michael here and ask him a question. Who do you think are the justices to watch, because they did seem split on this?
Yeah. So one quick statement is Trump didn't bring this case.
Right.
So this is not Trump being Trump seeking a delay. This was brought by this guy Fisher, who was convicted and of this crime, and the Supreme Court took it independent of any Trump motion to take it. Trump just may be the beneficiary of a decision. But it seemed as if, as is always the case nowadays, Roberts, Kavanaugh, Comey Barrett are the ones to keep an eye on. It seemed as if Gorsuch and Alito and Thomas were going to say otherwise has to be read in conjunction with the previous sentence, and that relates to destruction of paper, and that's what this statute was intended. That's the whole context in which it was written, and so we're going to apply it. And if Congress wants to amend it, that's their prerogative, and just say that. So I'd keep, because it seemed as if the liberal three were of the mind of the Brian Karam school of thought that
That's the Oxford School, not mine. But
the word means what the word means, and otherwise can mean in any other way. It doesn't have to be in a similar way.
Well, with that thought, in a similar way, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, so much more to unpack. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. We're talking to you, and we need your help. As you probably know, independent journalism is a vital pillar of our democracy. Like everything else, it's not free. We're asking all longtime listeners of the show to help support us by becoming a member on Patreon. For the price of a latte, you can help guard democracy. Join us today at patreon.com/JATQ podcast to help us keep bringing you the podcast you love and the facts you deserve.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karen, with our weekend review, Just Ask the Press, with former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and editor-at-large and chief White House correspondent for CQ Roll Call, John T. Bennett. I left a little time here for this one. Israel and Iran. Israel whacked a guy in Iran, and so Iran replied with many dozens, hundreds of missiles, which were broken up, and either we were the sneakiest guys on the planet, we figured it out, or we got a tip, but, you know, we helped destroy those missiles. Very few casualties, I think only one in Israel. And then Israel responded, blew something up, and Iran said, ha, 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 didn't even hurt me. What the hell's going on, John?
Well, part of what's going on here is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has successfully flipped the script of scrutiny off of him. And this all started when on April 1st, when he gave an order for the IDF to take out a Iranian Revolutionary Guard Quds Force commander in Syria at a diplomatic facility. That was, a senior official told me this week, that was part of Biden's frustration that prompted an April 4th call with Netanyahu when he read him the Riot Act about various things, including Gaza and his conduct of the conflict.
Gave him the ultimatum that wasn't an ultimatum, but we all know it was an ultimatum.
But was never treated as such by President Biden, even though he said the words, he didn't really back it up. And for instance, after all of this, Iran countered, Israel countered to the counter. And what we have now is what was supposed to be a high-level virtual meeting between U.S. and Israeli officials, I believe on Thursday, about Rafah, a part of Gaza where Netanyahu told Palestinian civilians to go while he, you know, bombed most of the strip, and now he wants to attack. So the U.S. was trying to come up, give them some other options, other ways to do it to protect the civilians. The call was really about Iran.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's be honest. Yes. Even though Corinne on Friday wouldn't admit it, it was about Iran. So Netanyahu has flipped the script successfully. Iran, you know, with a very disproportional response, firing 300 things at Israel and then saying, we didn't mean to kill anyone. But I've got some riverfront. If you believe that one, I've got some oceanfront property in Nevada that I'd like to sell.
Well, I've got a broken bridge in there. Yeah. I'll sell you too. Well,
there are a lot of those, but that's a different podcast. And, you know, so what we have here is a very dangerous situation. And I get, the more I thought about it yesterday afternoon and last night, the more I understood the Biden administration yesterday not even acknowledging the Israel counter to the counterstrike. That's a signal to Iran, okay, this can be over now.
Yes.
If everybody just calms down and don't respond to their response, just let it be.
And Iran did that.
And we're channeling through the Swiss and other people these messages to them. So as of right now, it looks like this is going to pass. But
you know, you have one missile defense system that jams or fails, and some of those missiles, you know, land in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem or wherever they were targeted. And we're talking about a much different situation today. There would be a hot war going on right now. So this could have gotten out of hand very quickly.
We used missiles, by the way, we had never used in warfare before. Right. We tried out the new stuff. We wanted to try out the new armor.
It was pretty remarkable. It was all hands on deck last Saturday night. I mean, you had the Saudis and the Iraqis and Qatar and the Jordanians with us on this. They were providing intelligence. They were firing missiles to knock things out of the sky. It was very remarkable, the coalition that Biden put together to help Israel. And just days before, he's on the phone yelling at Netanyahu. It's a really remarkable couple of weeks.
It does show, I think, that Biden has a grasp on the international scene that far exceeds any other politician in the United States. I do.
He does.
Yeah.
He does. Now, some people are of the former defense secretary, Bob Gates, school of thought. Gates famously said that Joe Biden has been wrong about every foreign policy decision in the last 50 years. I would like to hear former Secretary Gates critique the events of the last few weeks, because it does seem like Biden had, you know, he handled this about as well as anybody could.
Yeah, I think he downplayed it the way he did downplay it was in order to defuse it. And that's mm-hmm. why he didn't call it an ultimatum. Yeah. That's why he didn't go after Iran. I think all of it was a stratagem. But I still think at the end of the day, we still live in, I have seen, you know, like social media posts with evangelical Christians praising Iran, because this means that Israel is isolated and thus ushering in the end times and the rapture. Those people are damn well nuts. But I think to the point, I guess, Michael, is it not still very, very volatile and dangerous?
Can I say I missed this story. I was focused on the Taylor Swift double album release. And so
it was a great
I'm
album.
Just catching up to what you guys are talking about, because my priorities of course shifted to a double album, took me by surprise completely. Yeah, it's volatile and it's not the album, the Middle East. The album seems sort of sad from what I've read about it. A lot of broken hearts, heartache. But the situation that's complicated is Netanyahu's personal situation. I keep hearing people that say that as soon as Netanyahu is out of government, as soon as he's no longer in control, he's going to jail. And so if you have, let's see, I can keep this going or I can go to jail. That, you know, is an incentive to keep things going. And now I don't know, that's very cynical. And I would not like to ascribe that motive to Netanyahu. But it seems that a lot of people who know a lot more about the region seem to think that his decision-making is in part informed by his personal problems. And if that's the case, my goodness, you know, you got world peace on the one hand and your personal liberty perhaps on the other, and I'll go with my personal liberty. I don't get it. But
are we talking about
hopefully,
Trump?
hopefully everyone has, you know, had their dose of testosterone, and we can now go back to some level of normalcy. And the word normalcy and the Middle East doesn't really fit in the same sentence. But where we were, and then, but that said, we still have Gaza, and there's no solution that seems imminent there. We still have hostages. I mean, wasn't it the story that there was a deal to be made with Hamas where they would release hostages, 40, I think was the number. And they said, we don't have 40 hostages. That was a terrifying and unreported enough statement that these innocent hostages would now no longer be alive. Now, you know, you could say, well, yeah, they were killed like the 30,000 Palestinians in the course of Israelis bombing. And if that's the case, then that's the case. But if they were not cared for and died, that's sort of like a Geneva Convention-ish sort of issue.
Yeah, and I don't know that we'll ever be able to prove any of that, or we'll ever know. I want to leave you with a last thought on this, John, as we, you know, look forward. I'll ask you both this question. This comes from a woman who actually gave us her real name in an email. So for Elaine Nolan, the question is, what do you think is the most overreported story and the most underreported story of this year so far?
Oh, wow. Put me on the spot.
I just did.
These are always hard questions for me because I get so involved in what I'm doing day to day and what I'm covering. I know that she's asking about news, but I think the most overreported piece of journalistic topic, and this is going to sound weird maybe, is the NFL. I think everything's ESPN manages to make the NBA playoffs about the NFL. They made the Masters golf tournament all about the NFL. So I'll go there. I think crime is the most misleading thing that we're reporting on right now. I can't tell if crime is up or down. I just think that's something that needs more attention as we get closer to the election. So, I'll go with those two.
Michael.
So Donald Trump for both. I think that we're sort of overreporting his legal situation, you know, wall-to-wall coverage on jury selection, really, and underreporting his policies that are being, you know, sort of quietly written by groups of people who are, I think, very anti-democratic. And we're not reporting enough on what does a second Donald Trump administration look like as a policy matter around critical matters, infrastructure, employment, international affairs. I mean, what is his administration's policies going to be? I bet if you asked a half a dozen reporters, they have no idea what his policies are. Policies are being written. but those policies are being written. He's got the Stephen Millers and the Jason Millers and the Catos and the Heritages, and they're writing policy. And I think people need to know way more about what Trump stands for in that respect, and less about his day-to-day, did he violate his gag order? Yeah, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But big deal. What if he is proposing, as he appears to be, the dismantling of the Justice Department?
Yeah.
Well, you know, why are we not talking about the dismantling of the Justice Department policy position that he's working on, and less worried about, you know, whether he violated a gag order and talking about Michael Cohen? That doesn't matter one whit. Well, dismantling of the Justice Department matters a whole lot more. But of course, as we've talked about this before, reporters are much more comfortable talking about easy, who's up, who's down, what team is winning, what team is losing, than hard policy positions. I think probably more read People magazine than they read The Economist.
They read? I'm not even sure they read. I'm going to go past headlines. I'll go with the Trump antics is the most overreported, and I think one of the most underreported or misreported, maybe as John called it, poorly reported, is the causes of inflation, which continue. I think greedflation is a real thing. There seems to be no viable economic reason for inflation or price gouging, as it was called when I was younger. And I'd like to see more of that. So
I'd like to take mine back. You guys, those are really good.
I liked yours too.
Well, I might just say for the listening audience, I looked over John's shoulder. This is what he was going to say. I stole his notes.
With that said, we'd like to thank you for joining us for Just Ask the Press. Another edition has come to close. And as usual, we'll start with you, Michael. What would you like to plug?
My podcast still is what I'm plugging. It's called That Said with Michael Zeldin. And we have books that talk about a lot of the topics that we're talking about in the news today, but in their historic context. How did we get to be here? And we'll talk to Ed Ayers about the emergence of America in the 1800s. Next week, I talk to Fareed Zakaria about his book, The Age of Revolutions, which talk about past revolutions and how that inform us about essentially the current revolution of our culture and identity that's going on now. So I would ask people to listen to it. And I would invite them, if they like it, to give me a review on the Apple Podcast app. And that would be very helpful. And very
there you go. John, your turn. What are we plugging, brother?
Both chambers of Congress working this weekend, and the Senate, it looks like, will have to come back after Passover to wrap up that big national security spending bill. You can follow my colleagues and my work as well at rollcall.com. And a shout out to our newsroom. We did a lot of good stuff this week. So good job, everybody.
There you go. And the name of this podcast is called Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam. Thanks for joining us. And we will catch you again next time.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. We're talking to you, and we need your help. As you probably know, independent journalism is a vital pillar of our democracy. Like everything else, it's not free. We're asking all longtime listeners of the show to help support us by becoming a member on Patreon. For the price of a latte, you can help guard democracy. Join us today at patreon.com/JATQ podcast to help us keep bringing you the podcast you love and the facts you deserve.